Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the NoSilicast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever-so-slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, May 4th, 2008, and this is show number 149. Well, I had a great day today. I had so much fun. Kyle let me wax his car. Oh, that was just awesome. I clayed and I waxed and I polished and I tire blacked. It's just a dream come true. He's such a good kid to let me do that. He's the best. Would you believe it had been 7 months since I last waxed his car? Oh, I'm slipping. Lindsay tells me the problem is that I wax her car every time she shows up, and I've just been neglecting his car. I did have a lot of trouble with water spots, though. You know, everything I did, I had a lot of trouble getting the water spots off. He gets sprinkled because he can't park in the garage. I may have to move into a new house so I can get a three-car garage. You know, this just isn't good. I'll have to talk to Steve about moving. We'll see what we can do. Well, guess what? In 3 short weeks, it will be the 3-year anniversary of the NoSilicast. As all of you know, I couldn't have done this without all your encouraging emails and help with audio reviews and all that stuff. It's just been great how many people have sent in comments and questions and things like that. So, we have a really big, important homework assignment, and you only have 2 weeks to pull it off. I want everyone listening to send me a short 1 to 2 minute kind of audio clip telling me how you found this show in the first place. I'll put all the clips together and play them together on the anniversary show. Wouldn't that be fun? It'd be fun for me anyway. I've always been curious about how you guys ever found me in the first place. Send your audio comments as MP3s to nosilicast@gmail.com, and I'll try to play as many as I can. Don't be shy. Do it. I especially want Neil to send one in. Okay, Neil? Well, Chris Morrison sent in an awesome iTunes tip that really solves a problem. I'm really excited about this one. Here's what he said. Hi, a short little something I just discovered. Thought your listeners might like to know too. I've always wanted to save certain locations in the iTunes store to come back to later. Turns out when you drag and drop the rightmost portion of the title bar, and he put a picture for me in the show notes, he says grab the right-hand portion of the title bar and drag it to your desktop. You get essentially a URL to that area of the store. Now I can check in on BBC America for new offerings without waiting through the store's awful menu system. Well, Chris, I'm really excited about this. I'm with you on how bad iTunes navigation is. It's just dreadful. I could have used this just last week. I was doing a demo for Take Your Child to Work Day, or as I prefer to call it, Take Your Rotten Little Brats to Work Day, and this would have been really handy to drill right into the kids' shows on iTunes. Well, luckily, Chris also included a couple of the web links in his email as attachments, and all I had to do was double-click on them to be drilled right into the iTunes store to see what the BBC is offering today. The links themselves didn't work. It was the attachments of the links that did work. Just kind of curious. Bet somebody out there understands why. In any case, Chris, thanks so much for sending this along. I will definitely be using this. Well, last week on Chit Chat Across the Pond, Bart and I talked about his threat down that he did of the GIMP against Photoshop Elements in creating a tilt-shift image. If you didn't catch last week's show, this is a weird photo editing technique where you take a real photograph of a real-life scene, say something from way up above, and you make it look like a scale model. Bart put a great tutorial on his website of how to create this illusion using the GIMP. I tried to follow his instructions using Photoshop Elements, but I just couldn't figure out how to do it because I couldn't find layer masking inside Photoshop Elements. Sean Carruthers of the great podcast Lab Rat sent me in some instructions on how I could do layer masking with Photoshop Elements, but I wasn't smart enough to follow them, I'm afraid. So anyway, I had trouble with that, but luckily Gerard from the Netherlands actually understands how layers, masking, and gradients work because he sent in a video screencast showing how to create a tilt-shift illusion in just 90 seconds using Photoshop Elements. I don't want to spoil his video by telling you how to do it, so I put the video in the show notes. I also included 2 images, one done by Bart in the GIMP and one done by me in Photoshop Elements using Gerard's instructions. You can tell which one is which by looking at the alt tags or hovering over the images, but I think they look pretty close together. Gerard, thank you so much for taking the time to do this. Talk about a picture's worth 1,000 words. A video is worth 1,000,000, I guess. Good friend of the show and a good friend of mine, Lynn York, wrote in asking if I knew anything about some software called Photo to Movie from lqgraphics.com. I'd never heard of it, but I'm always interested in slideshow applications, so I decided to do a full review. I think an essential sales tool today is to have video tutorials explaining how your software works, and LQ Graphics has done a fantastic job using this marketing tool. They have beginning and more advanced tutorials all done in video that really help you understand what this piece of software is capable of doing. You know me, I'm not going to read manuals unless you hold my feet to the fire. But just sit back and watch a video showing off your tool? You betcha. I'm there. Well, Picture-to-Movie is an application designed to take still images and turn them into beautiful slideshow movies. You can do this with iMovie and other tools, but with Photo-to-Movie, it really focuses on just this one objective. So it's really put the right pieces together, especially in terms of usability, to help people make fabulous slideshow movies. First of all, Photo-to-Movie runs on both a Mac and Windows, so everyone gets to play. You know how I like that. Second of all, you can import pictures and music from iPhoto and iMovie, but you don't have to use iPhoto to enjoy Photo-to-Movie. The media browser takes you into your iPhoto library automatically, but it also includes your pictures folder, so if you're anti-iPhoto like me, you can still get to your photos. Heck, you can even skip the media browser and just drag photos from the Finder right into Photo-to-Movie. When you first import photos, they're all given a set duration, the Ken Burns effect is applied, and a nice fade-through is given between photos. That's half the battle done right there. But unlike many of the canned programs, you have complete flexibility to change the way these photos will act in your final production. They did a really interesting thing in how they display the images in the timeline. They actually stagger them up and down to illustrate that the photos are overlapping with a fade-in and fade-out. That really helps visually in figuring out how you want it to look when you're done, because you can literally see how much they overlap. I said you can change a lot of options. Just in the Ken Burns effect alone, that's the one, you know, that makes the photos sort of move across the screen, giving the illusion of motion. They let you modify the duration of the photo, the pause before and after, and the ease in and out. Oh, and choose between zoom and pan, zoom only, pan only, horizontal or vertical pan. Heck, you can even choose no motion at all, or just let the program randomize the effects. One of the features that really makes Photo-to-Movie stand out of the crowd is its ability to give you control over where and how the Ken Burns effect goes. When you click on an image, a little blue arrow comes up on screen, and dragging the two ends of it give you complete control over how the photo moves and how far it moves. If you've ever played with this effect before, like in iMovie, you know that many times the automatic Ken Burns will occasionally start the image on someone's belly and end up with half their head cut off the screen. Imagine being able to focus on Uncle Jimmy's face and have the photo slide to the golf trophy he's holding instead. That might be a little bit better. With each photo you put in the timeline, you can independently control the fade in and fade out rates by dragging a little handle on the photo in the timeline. You can drag in music and do the same kind of fade-in and fade-out control. If you really get into making slideshows, you'll appreciate both of these two controls, because you can make your slideshow so much more effective if you can time the music to a specific photo. My husband Steve loves to make slideshows, and he's become a master of this. It really increases the impact by timing the music and the images. Photo-to-Movie really makes this easy. So, you got your photos and music. What if you wanted to add a voiceover track? No problem. Just click the microphone button and you can record your voice too. Want titles? Of course Photo-to-Movie has titles. You can create them in just seconds using options, fade in and fade out, font options like spacing and colors and alignment. It even recognizes the title safe areas. You know, that's the area you have to stay in if you're going to display this later on a television set. Geez, I'm listening to this. I'm starting to sound like a salesperson for this product. It's a good thing that you know that if I don't like something about a product, I am definitely going to tell you. So you know I'm telling the truth when I'm this excited about a product. If I had to look for any improvements to Photo-to-Movie, I point out that rendering the previews is pretty jerky, so it's a little tough to figure out whether you've achieved the effect you were looking for. I had a little trouble with that, and it was strange because it wasn't really, you know, using up all my processors or anything. It was sitting at like 20-30%, but the images were still real jerky when I was in the preview mode. At one point, I wasn't able to figure out how to clip a music track to match how long I wanted the photos to last, but even that turned out to work out just fine. If you fade the music completely out after the photos, the video just stops at the right point automatically. By the way, it's very easy to match the photos to the music. All you have to do is select all the photos and drag the edge of the last photo till the collection of images snaps to the end of the song. It works perfectly. That's a nightmare operation in iMovie, by the way. I think you actually have to go into each picture and say, okay, I want this to be 3.7 seconds long and do them all and go, ah, okay, this, yeah, how about all of them at 3.8 and do a bunch of math? What a nightmare. I put a little video in the show notes that I created with a photo to movie, something I slapped together in just a few minutes and output to a web appropriate format. So don't judge it completely on that, but I had a lot of fun just throwing some pictures in and throwing some music on it. I've been blathering on for quite a long time now about photo to movie, but there's so much more this product can do. You really should check out the video tutorials over at lqgraphics.com if you haven't heard enough to convince you that you need photo to movie. Photo to movie is going to run you $50 US, and I think it's worth every penny. And you know my shareware threshold is usually $30, so that's saying something. Last week, I announced a new homework assignment called Dumb Question Corner. The idea is that I think a lot of people have questions they think are too dumb to ask, but I bet there's at least one other person out there with the same question. Well, this is a highly successful homework assignment because questions have been pouring in. Let's dig in and give these people some help. Susan Gerhardt wrote in and said, "Why isn't there a universal charger so we wouldn't have to carry so many cords, like for my laptop, cell phone, reader phone, Linux icon, plus extra batteries for the book port? I now have a 10-pocket backpack that takes an hour to pack up. Don't know much about electricity, but couldn't there be something like a USB hub with connectors for different devices? Or maybe there is such a thing escaping this lousy shopper." Well, Susan, 2 years ago at the All Things Digital Conference hosted by the Wall Street Journal, Martha Stewart stood up at the open microphone and asked the same question of the CEO of Sony. She illustrated the annoyance we all feel by pulling out every separate cable she had brought with her for the trip to the conference. It was actually hysterical. It was so funny. She had everybody in stitches. She was really attacking the CEO. And when she was done ranting at him and she said, "Why not?" he looked at her and he went, "Check, please." He did explain that they make a fair amount of money off of adapters, and he thought that might have something to do with it, which was actually kind of an honest answer. But the good news is that there are universal adapters. I did a search in Google on universal electronics adapter, and I got a hit right off the bat. For the WorldPack 120 from mfueldirect.com, that's M-F-U-E-L direct.com. This wasn't the only one, it was just the first one I found. This device is not cheap, it's 250 smackaroonies, but it comes with 12 notebook hot tips, 6 USB hot tips, and 7 cell phone hot tips. On the website, they say, "Patented adapters eliminate the need to carry separate charging units. Charge any notebook and iPod, cell phone, PDA, portable DVD player, digital camera, camcorder, portable video game, or MP3 player simultaneously from any power source, AC wall outlet, DC cigarette lighter, airplane, boat, or RV." I got to tell you, I haven't tried any of these devices, and maybe I should, but at $250, maybe I'll carry a bunch of stuff, but they are out there. In any case, great question, Susan. I bet a lot of people had that same question. Hi Vu wrote in with a real puzzler. This is what he said. "Hi, Allison. I would like to thank you for your offer in the dumb question department. I have this burning question, which I posted elsewhere but did not get any response. Too dumb? I've always been wondering what the number next to a calendar name in iCal means. Take a look at the picture I attached. Again, I appreciate your help." The great thing about Dumb Question Corner is you can't send in a question that's too dumb. This question had me stumped at first because I don't have a number next to there in my iCal. But I found the answer over at Macworld.com, of all places. In the article, they were talking about group calendars where you're sharing with others, but this is what they said. "iCal notifies the members of your group whenever you invite them to a meeting. A number next to the calendar name alerts each person to invitations or messages about canceled events. Notifications themselves appear in the lower left corner of the window. If they're not visible, click on the Hide Show Notifications button shown with an envelope icon." There you go. Dumb question answered. Hugo Poon wrote in with a question to Dumb Question Corner that I didn't actually know a good way of answering. His question was, 1080i, 720p, explain all that. So I thought I'd bring in Steve, because Steve watches a lot more television than I do, so I thought maybe he could answer our questions. How you doing today, Steve?
Fine, Allison. How are you?
Pretty good. So what's up with this 1080i, 720p? What's the story here?
Well, in a short sentence, basically those two numbers define the vertical resolution in a high-definition TV. But to draw an analogy, think of mowing a lawn. Think of the lawn as the television face, and the rows of the lawnmower going back and forth as the lines of resolution. Okay, so 1080 means the number of rows that the lawnmower will pass back and forth to complete the lawn mowing episode. And
okay.
720 is a less high resolution to do the same job. Okay, so those two numbers talk about resolution, and then let's talk about the I versus the P. I stands for interlaced, and P stands for progressive. So when we talk about interlaced, what we think of the lawnmower going back and forth but skipping every other row, let's say only mowing the even rows.
So would that be I or P?
That would be the interlaced or I.
Okay.
And then...
So it does like 1, 3, 5, 7, 9, then it does 2, 4, 6, 8, 10.
Right. And it does. It completes one pass of the lawn every 30th of a second.
Okay.
So it's moving along pretty quick. 30 times a second, it's mowing that lawn.
It's doing all of them or every other one?
Every other one.
Okay.
Whereas the P, or progressive, is mowing the entire lawn, 1 through 720
okay.
P, without having to skip, you know, odd versus even. It's doing all of them sequentially.
In the same length of time that the other one does half of them?
Correct.
Oh, okay.
Let me just also add that we're talking high-definition TV. The normal TV number of rows or lawnmower stripes is 480, and it's normally I or interleave.
So that's what they call standard def TV.
Standard def TV, right.
Okay.
And the other thing I need to mention is that 30 times a second is the standard for the U.S. and Canada and Japan. But in other countries, European countries and Asia and Australia, Africa, it's 25 times a second.
Okay. So now, if in a practical sense, though, if you had a 1080i TV and 720p TV side by side, since one is a higher resolution, but it's interlaced, the other one's progressive, but it's a lower resolution, which one looks better?
Yeah, that's a good question. And to the average viewer, under average viewing circumstances, you might not be able to tell the difference. However, there are some special conditions where one shines better than the other. And those are interlaced or 1080i with more rows, but repeating every other frame,
mm-hmm.
Gives you higher resolution, but is better for more slowly changing scenes on the TV. So if you have scenes of, let's say, landscape, where there's not a lot of movement in the scene, but you want that high resolution, like the Planet Earth series, that would be best for the 1080i. If you have a quickly changing scene like sports,
action film,
sports events, then you want to be refreshing that screen in its entirety every 30 seconds. And 720p would be better for those circumstances.
So today, though, you can actually get 1080p TVs, so you can get the best of both worlds. You get the higher resolution and progressive scan.
Certainly. That is the direction that the broadcast standards are moving towards. Not all TVs support that yet, but many of them are coming out with 1080p, and that will ultimately be the direction of high-definition TV.
Now, do things like the Blu-ray players, do they support 1080p?
Yes. When I say high-definition, there are really a couple different meanings for that. One is just the resolution, the high resolution with which you have the viewing experience, and that applies both to the HD TV or Blu-ray formats.
Okay.
The other context is just high-definition TV, which applies to both.
Okay. One question I really wonder is whether if you took a normal human being, not a video file or an audio file or whatever, if you just stood them in front of a TV, would they think an interlaced signal at 720 or at 1080i, for example, that would look great, wouldn't it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and it for most scenes and most audiences, most viewers, that will look fantastic and be heads and tails above a standard def TV.
Okay, so don't lie awake at night worrying which TV you should buy. If it's going to cost you a ton more money to get 1080p, maybe 1080i is just fine.
Yeah. Yeah, I would say so.
It probably depends on the size of the TV and what you're watching. It depends on the size of the room and all those kinds of things.
Right. But if you're a videophile and you're really picky about what you're watching, you might start looking for those differences, right, to justify the large amounts of money you've just spent on your 1080p.
Now, you wouldn't be speaking from your personal point of view by any chance.
Since I don't yet have a 1080p TV, but maybe someday.
I think he's beckoning for Father's Day here or something. I don't know what he's doing. All right. Well, I think we have come closer to understanding the question from Hugo, and I appreciate your help, Steve.
My pleasure.
Well, I really enjoyed doing that little interview there with Steve, and you got to hear him too, so that's exciting. And I got to play with my Zoom H2. You know how happy that makes me. I'm so glad you guys sent in all these dumb questions. Just think about this. The dumber you think they are, the more likely I'll be able to answer them, so bring it on. Really keep those things coming. I really, really getting a big kick out of doing this. Well, I haven't mentioned in ages how great Honda Bob's website is over at hdabob.com. Bob is a really, really good teacher. He's not one of those mechanics, you know, like that likes to try to pretend everything is mysterious and don't worry your pretty little head about it. You're too dumb to understand. Instead, he really enjoys explaining things. Another thing that's odd for a mechanic is he's a very good writer. He's put these talents to use and created a website dedicated to educating people about all the various parts of a car and how they interact. He asked me to draw your attention to his explanation of tires over at hdabob.com. Now, you might think that's kind of a dull subject, but I personally care deeply about this subject because I actually had 18 flat tires in just 2 years. I am not making this up. I started counting when I got to like 9 or 10 because it was ridiculous. I had the worst ring of luck. Nails and staples must have been chasing my car. We were broke, too, so I had retreads that kept falling apart. I'd come out to my car and it'd be flat again. I even had two tires slashed one day by a vandal. Heck, towards the end of that streak, people who drove me places were getting flat tires. Never forget, we got in the car with my friend Drew, and I said, "So, Drew, you got a spare tire, right, and a jack?" And he says, "Oh, yeah, I got one of those." Guess what? He didn't. Well, actually, he had a spare tire, but he had no jack, and we got a flat tire because I was in the car. Luckily, that has stopped for quite some time here, but I take tires very seriously. On Bob's site, he gives us detailed explanations of the tread and sidewall, all about the inside of the tire, like the beads and reinforcing cords. He even explains all those numbers and letters that are on the side of the tire, like P195/60R14. Haven't you wondered about those? He talks about how much air pressure you should maintain in your tires and how important it is to check your spare tire as well. Trust me, my spare tire is always ready for the job. And finally, he explains how to change a flat tire. You know, maybe I should go over and make sure he's written it up correctly because I'm an expert on that, as it turns out. If you're lucky enough to live in the LA or Orange County areas and you would like outstanding and convenient in-home care for your Honda or Acura, give Honda Bob a call at 562-531-2321 or send him an email over at hdabob@aol.com. HDA Bob's mobile service is not affiliated with Honda Acura or Honda Worldwide. It's time for another exciting episode of Chit Chat Across the Pond with Bart Bouchatz. How are you today, Bart?
I am in good form today. I got to wear my shorts for the first time all year. Summer has arrived, although it's not staying long, because there's rain on the way in about an hour. But I got to go to the seaside. You know, it was cool.
Wow, that's fantastic. Good news. How's your broadband going?
Don't mention the war. Yeah, ice have gotten even worse. Those Muppets in Aircom haven't given me my account number yet, even though it's been connected since last week. So without an account number, I can't get broadband. So I have a phone that I'm paying for, but I still can't get broadband on it because Aircom are Muppets, and it's just, as I expected, it's painful.
Oh, no. So what do you think? Do you have a time estimate for us?
Oh, fortnight if I'm lucky, I think.
Fortnight, that's European for 2 weeks?
That's Irish speak for 2 weeks, yeah, yeah. No, at the moment we're on the backup, because ice is so bad I couldn't hear you, although you could hear me. So I'm now on my little EVDO card, which isn't EVDO, it's HSDPA. But anyway, which means the latency is insane. So it's a bit like talking on a satellite phone. It's like I say something and stop, and then nothing happens for ages, and then you talk. But anyway, we're talking, so we're on the way.
Well, that's good. That's good. Well, let's see. We wanted to talk about, you did a blog post about OS X is 6 months old now. I'm sorry, Leopard is 6 months old, and what you think about it.
Yeah, I thought it would be a good opportunity to sit back and actually think, okay, we've had 6 months to really get bedded in. So what aspects, you know, if in the morning someone were to force you to go back to Tiger, what would you miss and how terrible an ordeal would that be, was sort of the way my thinking for writing the post. And I have to say, my conclusion, it would be a pretty terrible ordeal. I have really become highly dependent on the Leopard features to increase my productivity, really. Yeah, it would really, really annoy me if I lost all the Leopardy goodness.
So what kind of things do you think you would miss? Because I've actually pondered this a little bit when I think about telling someone that they definitely need to go to Leopard. And I think, well, what do I really, really care about?
Well, I think the top three for me, and I've been trying in my head to see which is more important than the other, but honestly, I can't decide. Spaces, without a shadow of a doubt, has completely changed the way I work, and definitely for the better. I can now group tasks together, and when I want to concentrate on something, I move into that space, and everything else just vanishes out of sight, doesn't annoy me. I stay there till I'm done, and then I move back to one of my other spaces for Twitter or whatever else happens to be hidden over there. So I sort of have space one contains every distraction there is. It contains my email, contains my web client for looking at various bulletin boards, it contains my Twitter client, my chat client. They're all clustered in space one. And the other three spaces, because I use four spaces, all have different tasks within them. Space two is where my blog is, etc. So, you know, I can move into a space and sort of zone into that. And I really, really would miss that if I lost it.
Now, I keep trying to give spaces a chance. And the other day I thought, okay, now I've got a really good application for it. I was trying to work on, I was doing the tilt shift photography thing. And I was in Photoshop Elements. And Photoshop Elements has, it pretty much takes over your whole screen. You can't even see behind it. So you can't have another window open that you can see. It puts a gray background. And so you can't do anything else at the same time. So I thought, okay, well, I'm going to put, the instructions that Bart wrote up, I'm going to put those up in Safari and I'll put them in a different space. And then I'll just, whatever it is, shift tab, command tab, whatever, back and forth between the applications, and it'll automatically switch me from space to space. But the problem was I also had a Safari window open in the same space, so it kept going to that one first. And so, okay, I closed that one. I don't know. It wouldn't switch back and forth like I wanted it to, and I finally got disgusted and turned it off again.
Okay. Apple Tab with spaces is broken. That is its one weakness, in my opinion. And my solution has been to stop relying on Apple Tab most of the time. Control and the arrow keys are the way to navigate around your spaces. So control left, control right, etc.
So if I'd just done that, I would have been able to get to the one I wanted, right?
Exactly, because it would have been just sitting there in the space next to you. So control left arrow, go over and read. Control right arrow, come back. That's also why I've become so fond of Exposé, because if you don't Apple Tab between your applications, well, then that's why I tied Exposé into my mouse button, so I could click and see the windows very easily.
Oh, okay. Now, was Exposé there in Tiger?
Exposé, yes. Exposé, I think, is Panther.
Okay.
Tiger
okay.
Actually only had two big things, if memory serves. It had three. It was, we got the dashboard in Tiger, we got Automator in Tiger, and we got the first attempt at Spotlight, which was, you know, you could see it had potential, but that's about it, really.
So I think one of the things I'm looking forward to when you get good broadband is I would love to watch your workflow and how you do use spaces, and we'll do some screen sharing. That'll be fun when you have real broadband.
Well, I'm game to do it to my work machine, actually, but if you're ever available while I'm around and work and not busy.
That might have to be at 5:30 in the morning for me. We could try it.
Yeah, I'm always game. Sort of the three I can't decide which is more important. Spaces is definitely revolutionary, and it has changed the way I work, and I love it to bits, apart from the fact that it has this one flaw that I hope they fix. I really hope they fix, but they haven't yet. But it's young.
What's the flaw?
Then the other one, it's the fact that the behavior when you command tab... Okay. If you have one application with Windows in multiple spaces, it's potluck where you end up. I have been trying to find some sort of logic, rhyme, or reason as to why it should choose one Firefox window over another, one space over another, and I can't figure it out. So I've given up trying to figure it out. It's just, it's potluck. And so if you have an application in multiple spaces, you don't get to it with Command Tab, because you just have no idea where you'll end up. Then the other ones I absolutely could not live without is definitely the new Spotlight, which I almost never use to search for files, but I use it very often, which sounds a bit strange, but I always use it to launch applications because I find it's a good application launcher and it saves me relying on third-party stuff, so I can sit down at any Leopard machine and be at home and comfortable. And I kind of like that because I got very attached to application launchers in Tiger, and as soon as I ended up on a machine that didn't have them, I was lost. Whereas now I can go to any Leopard machine and I'm away without any third-party software. The other thing I use it for all the time is as a calculator. You literally type in a mathematical equation and it will give you the answer. No need to go to calculator app or to open up dashboard or whatever. Just straight there, Apple space, type in your sum and you get your answer. So I love that. And then also, I can't spell. I'm terrible at spelling. And I can never remember whether the plural of hope, the past tense of hope has two P's or one P. So if you type in a word, you'll actually get the dictionary definition as one of the results. And so I can quickly see from just the tiny little bit that you get in the dropdown, oh, okay, it's with one P or two or whatever. And also whether below or bellow is one L or two L's and stuff like that. So I use it for that an awful lot, actually, just check that I'm using the right spelling of a word.
I never thought of using it for that at all. I do like the idea of being able to sit down at any computer, because it makes me crazy when I sit down at one of my kids' computers when they don't have Quicksilver running. But if you don't depend on Quicksilver and it's always there in Spotlight, that would be a good idea. Now, the calculator is not reverse Polish notation, though, right?
No, it's proper. I don't know what the formal name is for our notation, but it's plain and ordinary, I'm afraid. But it's very useful because I'm usually looking at it to get the VAT. So you take the price, multiply by 1.21, and you have your answer for the VAT.
So Spotlight in spaces.
So quick look. It has become alien to me, the concept that you should have to open up an application to look at a photograph or a video or a HTML page or a Word document or an Excel sheet or anything just to see what's inside it. To me, that has become a completely alien concept to me, this idea that you need to fire up a big ugly app just to have a quick look. I utterly depend on quick look. I think it is the best thing ever. Love it to bits.
I definitely agree with you on that. I don't, it's completely natural just to hit that space bar. I use it in Apple Mail too. I love to just, click on the app. Like if somebody sends you one of those things with a whole bunch of photos, I'm not going to scroll through and look at those photos. I'll hit the space bar. I can make it full screen, flip through them. I definitely take that for granted. I love that feature.
Yeah, and it's cut to the point now where on web interfaces, I expect to be able to hit space to make stuff get bigger. Obviously, it doesn't work in some contexts, but it's actually become so ingrained into my psyche that the spacebar means make it big and let me see now. And I try to use it everywhere, even where it doesn't exist. Thankfully, it does work within iPhoto. Otherwise, I think it'd go absolutely insane. So they're definitely the big three obvious ones. But then when you think a little more, what particularly I find very important is the fact that when something goes wrong with a network connection, you don't get that annoying spinning beach ball that locks up the entire Finder, because that used to drive me insane, especially when you have terrible broadband like I do. If anything goes wrong on a network drive on Tiger, it was one thread for the whole Finder, so if that thread got locked up by a network problem, that's it, your Finder was gone, have a nice day, beach ball of death. That is history with Leopard, because every connection is separate. And so if it locks up, it's only it that's locked up, and the rest of the Finder works fine.
Bart, I had no idea that had changed, but you're right. The other day, husband's machine was connected as a network drive, and he had shut down. And I was happily working away, and all of a sudden a little message came up and said, by the way, that's gone. And I forgot, it used to be you'd have this mysterious problem that you'd be working away and going, why am I locked up? And you couldn't figure out why, and it took forever. Yep. And then all of a sudden it would, after like 2 minutes, it would say, oh yeah, that guy shut his machine down. I had not realized that was gone.
Yeah, it's a big one. And I suppose the other one for me, which I know you're going to disagree with me on, is Time Machine, which has completely changed the way I do my backups. Yeah, I actually think I took a bit of time and energy to configure it at first, and I think that's probably paid dividends, because I immediately configured it not to back up certain folders, and I very religiously used those sort of scratch space folders, as I call them in my head, to do anything that involves big files. So I have a folder called temp in my documents folder, and it is, you know, the Time Machine has been instructed not to back up temp. And so whenever I'm doing some sort of editing or something with a huge file or whatever, it'll all be done in temp. And then when I'm done, I'll move it into the main My Documents folder, and then Time Machine will do its magic. So I'm very careful about what I don't back up. And I think that's what saved me. Because you in particular do an awful lot of editing with, you know, horribly big files. And if you don't have that kind of setup where you've predetermined where your safe zones are, I can imagine it would not work well.
Well, I think what bothers me about Time Machine is they're not clear on what they are backing up. So I went in and I set up my mother-in-law with Time Machine. Her machine has so little stuff on it. I'm not kidding. She has 12 Excel files. You know, she has hardly anything on this machine. Had it for 6 months. You know, she's got, I think it was 300 photos, something like that. I went in and I set up Time Machine and I said, don't back up this. I gave it everything I could think of not to back up. And it was 23 gigabytes. I don't know what it is backing up. It's what I want it to do is tell me what it's backing up.
Well, you can. You just go in and have a look. That's the great thing. You can just browse the backup file system. It's a normal file system. Go in and look around.
That's a good point. Somebody sent me something. Somebody sent me some third-party thing, and I got to go find out. I thought I had it open in a tab, but I'll go find it later. Somebody sent me a tool that would let you see exactly what it's backing up. But you're right, I could just kind of navigate to the folder, huh?
Yeah, I think that's actually a great feature, because one of the biggest problems is if you have a backup that you actually can't restore from, but you don't know it, you're actually worse off than not having a backup, because you have this warm, fuzzy feeling of security, which is not correct. Whereas at least with the Time Machine, it's there. Just have a look. It's not in any sort of funny file folder or anything like that. It's just a plain ordinary files. You can drag and drop them, do whatever you like with them. They're just there. You can use the fancy space age silly GUI if you like, but to me that's just a waste of bits. I'm much, much happier to go into the file system.
Don't want to be wasting those bits, you know?
Yeah, I just it's so un-Apple-like. It's such a tacky, tacky display. They know better. They can do better. It just disappoints me.
Yeah, I am glad to see that it is something you can drill down into. At first, I thought it was going to be some weird, you know, packaged up proprietary file. But the fact that you can just drill down into it does help. I'm not sure the temp thing would actually help us, though, because even though we're doing these big files, we are saving them throughout the process. So like Steve in particular does these video files that he's editing for iMovie and iDVD. Well, he may save that 12 times during a day. That's going to be 12 copies of a half a gig file. So
yeah, but none of those are going to get backed up.
Yeah, they are.
They're not. Why would they? If he's working in a temp folder, why should they?
Why is he working in a temp folder?
If it's changed 12 times, he's not done.
Yeah, you're saying he should change where he saves it, save it into a temp folder?
Yeah, until you're done, and then you put it out. Yeah, and you make that temp folder not available in your, you know, not a Time Machine folder. That's what I do.
So that's changing your workflow too.
And you don't have this problem. It has actually put a very minor. I have this one folder. I call it temp, and it's in my documents, and that is my scratch space. And I do anything big in there. And then when I'm happy with it, I move it out, and I know it's backed up.
I see. Well, I still have to set up this weekend. I might have time to do it. I have to set up one of those time scheduler programs where it'll say, once a day to back up his files would be fine. The problem is it's backing up hourly and daily and weekly, and it never even gets to weekly to where it could throw stuff away before he's out of disk space, I think.
Yeah, but that's because he's working with such big files and changing them so often. I mean, you can't possibly expect poor Time Machine to keep up with that. So he's got to work in a place that isn't being Time Machined until he's done.
Yeah, that might be the way to go. Or at the end of every day, he just drags the file onto a backup drive. Might be easier than all
that
of
works
this.
Too. I like backups to be automated because I don't trust myself to remember, if you get what I mean. Because I had all these wonderful visions of using rsync every day. And I still use rsync. I have an offsite backup now, which means I'm now way more protected than I ever was, because I used to only back up at home. And now I have a drive sitting in work where I rsync to whenever my laptop comes in. So that's at least once a week, often more. So I now have, you know, if the house burns down, my data is still in work, which is nice. And I wouldn't have had that before Time Machine.
Now, luckily, since I work on a laptop, my laptop's always with me. So by definition, my laptop's either right here next to the backup drive in which case it's the first thing I'm going to grab because it's never more than 2 or 3 feet away from me because I'm just that nerdy. Or it's in my car and the backup drive is at home, so I think I'm protected, but nobody else in the family is. So, yeah, I don't know. There was one more thing I wanted to say about that, about doing the backups. Ever since I recorded you and I screwed up the recording once, I have now a schedule time that I run a non-automated backup. As soon as we're done recording, I hit that backup button because I never want to lose our recording again. So I now have have a process.
That was interesting.
Yeah, I think you were a bit grumpy with me that time.
Having said that, the second recording came out way better than the first.
That's true.
Well, I still don't think we should do it every week.
Shouldn't test it, huh? Well, let's see. No, what else is good about OS X or Leopard that need to talk about?
I think they're the big ones. What I also noticed is that when I started using Leopard, I had expected to like some things. And actually, it turns out they're just fluff. In particular, I was convinced I was going to absolutely love CoverFlow in the Finder. I thought it was the coolest thing ever. And it certainly is cool for showing off to people, but that's actually its only function. It's fluff.
I'm afraid I got to agree with you. I do, on very rare occasions, use it, but usually it's where I've got a gigantic pile of photos and I'm looking for the right photo and I get bored with it really quickly because it takes too long to find the right photo to flip through because it's doing all that great, crazy, cute graphics. So, yeah, I got to agree with you that.
I use List View always. So what I actually do is once you hit space, you can still actually use the arrow keys to flick through your files.
Yeah, so yeah, but it doesn't update very quickly.
Overflow.
Instantly. Oh, right, right.
So
I'm
not
sorry.
Using the nasty cover flow. You just to be certain of the first file, hit space, and use the down arrow until you find the one you want. Hit space again, and the one you want will be selected.
Yes, you're right.
Way
that's exactly how I do it.
Changing your Finder view and waiting for all those fancy animations and reflections and all that mumbo jumbo. So it is actually pure fluff, and I actually thought it would be useful, but it isn't.
You know, WebWiz is watching us on, listening to us and watching me on Ustream right now, and he just put in, he or she, I'm not sure, I think it's a he. Wrote in CoverFlow is really for showing Windows users how cool Macs are.
That's it. Yeah, that's the only use I've ever found for it. Because it has the instant wow effect, like Exposé used to and possibly still does. You know, it's a wow feature, but in actual day-to-day, trying to get work done in as efficient a way as possible, it doesn't feature.
Definitely. Now, one thing you haven't mentioned, and it might be because your broadband at home is so abysmal so far, is I've really been getting a lot of good use out of screen sharing through iChat. I recently upgraded my mother-in-law's laptop to Leopard, and then I helped them buy an iMac. And with screen capture on that through iChat, my father-in-law can contact me whenever he's stuck. He's had a few problems, like he had Excel lockup on him the other day, and he pops up in chat and he says, "Hey, Allison, you got time to help me with something for a second?" I say, "Sure." He shares his screen. We've got immediate audio. It gives you a 3-2-1, so you know not to, you know, belch when you're on recording there. And it comes up on screen. He can point exactly where the problem is. I can move my cursor around. I can circle with the mouse to say, "Click here, then click here. Here's what your problem is." And, you know, inside of 2 or 3 minutes, I was able to solve his Excel problem for him. So it was, it was just spectacular. It's really been a godsend for somebody, you know, that you're trying to help distantly. And sometimes I'm just like, okay, Ken, quit hitting the screen. Don't touch anything. I'm going to do drive now. And I go, click, 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 click. Okay, you're fine. He'll go, okay, good to go.
Yeah, I actually think if a couple of things were true, I would use it a lot. The first one being if my parents had a Mac. Hmm. I think I have Dad convinced that he probably wants one, he thinks, maybe. Next time the computer breaks, because he's not throwing it out till it's really broken. Mm. It's a Frankenstein computer with bits from many, many previous incarnations. Then if he had proper broadband, because he's out in the country, and if you think I have problems, he has way more problems. He has a total of one provider that he can choose from, which is satellite broadband, which has latencies around about the same as we get now, only always, and that's the best you can hope for. It's a 1 second ping time period.
Oh my gosh.
And then if I had broadband. So my broadband sucks, his broadband is laggy as anything, and he doesn't have a Mac anyway. So for all those reasons, it just ain't going to work. Screen sharing from within the Finder I have used on occasion when I'm trying to get... usually out of pure laziness, it has to be said. If for some reason the better half is doing something and then heads out and says, "Oh, will you stop that download, or will you make sure that's done, or will you do something?" Rather than getting up and going into the room and using, you know, that computer, I'll simply use the Finder and take the screen, do whatever I'm supposed to do, and then log out. But that's kind of pure laziness. I don't think that actually adds to my daily workflow.
You know,
I forgot one that I absolutely positively love, and I think I may have, I think barely mentioned the blog post as well. If you have .Mac, you basically have a Windows domain in a strange sort of way, because if you have two machines and they both have the same .Mac account set up on them, you can share through the Finder either screen and or files, which I use way more often, without a password. So my MacBook Pro and my Mac Mini both have the same .Mac account, i.e. mine, and I just click on them in the sidebar of the Finder, which, by the way, is greatly improved, and connect straight in. No password asked for, nothing, because they share the .Mac account, which is actually exceptionally handy. Although, you can just click remember me, and then it's done as well, I suppose. So maybe it's not that huge a saving, but I think it's cool.
You know, actually, that's a good segue into Jimmy Lee of IndioRadioChattanooga.com wrote in on your blog that how much easier networking is in Leopard. The fact that when you open up a window, you've got your little list of everybody on your network, that works really well now that I've got all my machines on the network correctly.
Except in work, where I actually had to turn that off, which you can do if you go into the advanced options somewhere, somehow. So all it says in mine is a button called everyone. Well, in work, we haven't got around to subnetting our network. So we have a class B, and there's a couple of thousand machines on it. And the Windows machines show up on the network too.
And they're not subnetted, so you're getting all of them just going, hi, you there? Are you there? Are you there?
Well, they're half subnetted. We're making our way through the network, but there is still an awful, awful lot of people sharing the Class B, and it's an ongoing project at work that has been... It was started before I started almost 3 years ago, and it's still ongoing. I think we're about half subnetted by now, but the point is there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people on the flat network, which is where my office is, and if I turn that on, I just get this insanely big list. I have to collapse anyway, so I just turned it off.
Oh, my gosh. Well, I do like it at home, and that's part of that laziness thing. I like to be able to just go in and grab a file, move some things around. I haven't actually tried screen sharing within the network. I've always been doing it, like I said, to my mother and father-in-law. By the way, I do have a great business model idea, and it's kind of a commune idea. I think what we really should do is we should set up a network of people who will help each other's parents with their problems. Because it's real easy to be patient with somebody else's mother or father, but it's really hard with your own. You're just like, no, you idiot.
You know? No, you see, the problem is I couldn't be trusted to remain civil with other people's mothers and fathers, because I think I'd be exactly as... I don't suffer fools very well, unfortunately. It's a flaw that I know I should work on. I have this terrible urge to just take them out and say, no, just do this.
Oh, I can be really patient with someone I don't know, but when I know them well, I'm expecting them to do the things that annoy me, and then they do, and so I'm already ready to be just, come on. So, Steve's dad is doing just fantastic. He's really doing well, but there are certain things that don't stick for him, and I'm trying to figure out ways, and I think if I weren't related to him, I would maybe be able to come up with these ways to make things stick. You know, why is it that he has to click on my name first before he enters screen sharing? And I keep telling him, it's so iChat knows who you want to screen share with. And I just can't get through that bit. So I don't know, maybe somebody who wasn't his daughter-in-law could figure it out.
Yeah, unfortunately, my grandparents all use Windows, so I get much worse problems over the phone. It's like, why doesn't this work? Because I plug it into this USB port instead of this USB port. It's like, well, Windows sees it as a whole new device. But it's the same device. Yes, but Windows doesn't know that. But that doesn't make sense. I know. How do you fix it? Always plug it into the same port.
My father-in-law always wants to know why it happened. You know, Excel died on him. Why? Well, I don't know. It got tired. Well, that doesn't make any sense. Did I do something? Did I make it happen? No, it just happens. Why? What do I do to make it not happen again? I don't know. It's just bad stuff happens sometimes. So,
by iWork, surely.
Yeah, really. Let's see. We've run about 25 minutes already, but we wanted to go quickly through a couple of little things here. You've been using an ergonomic keyboard for quite a long time, right?
Yeah. It's years now. I got RSI once in my youth, and I didn't enjoy it very much and decided I wasn't going down that road again. So I spent good money on... Yeah. I think I was a teenager at the time.
I believe you're half my age. Is that right? Okay. Keep going.
No, I had one of these horrible realizations yesterday. I think it was yesterday over Chinese and wine, that I'm 28 and therefore nearly 30.
Uh-oh.
It's one of those moments. Because I've always considered myself to be in my early 20s, but you can't say that anymore when you're 28, surely. Anyway, yes, so I've had an ergonomic keyboard for years, and I really, really love them. One of the first things I did when I started work was say, I want an ergonomic keyboard. And my boss, well, it's not the kind of thing a boss can argue with, is it? If they say no and then you get RSI, it's like, haha, I'll see you in court.
So, which
joined
one did
the ergonomic revolution, I hear. Yeah. I have a Logitech.
Okay, you are a Logitech fan.
I'm a huge Logitech fan. It was the Logitech Comfort or something it was called. And cordless, just by its name.
Cordless Comfort Duo. Now, I was starting to get some pain in my shoulder. And what I got was the Gold Touch adjustable keyboard. And the one I got is for Windows only. Well, it's not for Windows only, but it doesn't have a cute little Apple key and that sort of thing. So they do sell a Mac version as well. But where the Logitech is lifted up in the center, so it's kind of arched and your hands are at an angle, the Gold Touch allows you to set that angle and arch yourself. It has a ball joint between the two sides. So you can separate the two sides and rotate it to whatever angle you like. And you can also arch it up, or you can set the angle and then you kind of lock it in place. And I'm pretty happy with it. It's got a nice touch to it too.
Yeah, that sounds fantastic, actually. I suppose with the Logitech one, if it isn't the right shape for you, then you're sort of screwed, really. There's not much you can do about it. Luckily for me, my hands seem to be Logitech-shaped, so it's not a problem. But I can imagine, you know, if someone had big hands or something, or very small hands or whatever, it could be an issue. So I was looking at your one, and it looks pretty cool, I have to say.
It is pretty nice. It's not cheap. It's, I think, $125, something like that. My company gets a discount, so that's good. But I also went out and bought for myself the Logitech LX8 laser mouse that you recommended.
Yes, excellent. What do you think?
I think I like it. I was getting some weird tingling in my hand yesterday when I was using it, but I've been doing so many changes to my work setup. We rearranged everything. The ergonomist that came in, he took the arms off my chair, he moved the seat pan back, he took the laptop, put it up on a box parallel to my monitor, and I got the new keyboard and I got the new mouse, so I changed everything at the same time. So I got to mess around a while to see if I hope it's not the mouse bugging me, because I really like it. It's very responsive, just like you said. That was the one thing I was worried about, you remember?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You were convinced that it would be disastrous, but I'm glad it isn't.
Yeah, I'm really happy. It's very, very, very quick. No lag at all. As you might recall, I'm running Vista at work, and the drivers won't load. It starts loading, and it gets to about 1%, and it says, okay, I'm working on it. And about 4 hours later, it still says 1%. So I just loaded Service Pack 1 on my machine at work, and I'm going to try to load them again. But I can't do some of the finer adjustments I'd like to do, and I can't change what button is doing what, that sort of thing.
Oh, okay. That's a pity, because on the Mac, of course, you don't need drivers to do that, because OS X lets you do that by itself.
Yeah.
Because I don't run the drivers, as we know. Actually, it's funny you mention ergonomicists, because I got a visit from mine this week as well. Well, he wasn't really visiting me. He was sort of visiting with a chap in work who really badly injured his neck. So he was there for him. But while he was there, he had some free time. And he went, does anyone else want to, you know, my services? And I went, yes, please. So I nabbed him. And I discovered what I consider to be poor design by Apple, which is unusual, I think.
Hmm.
They usually think of things. And it's the Apple Cinema Display, of all things. There is no vertical adjustment.
Yeah.
If you are not Cinema Display height. So mine is now propped up with a book.
Oh, it's actually too low.
It's too low for me. It's only the 20-inch.
Okay. Maybe you need the 23 or the 30.
I think that'd work.
But from an ergonomic standpoint.
My boss. I think you should talk to my boss and see if you can arrange that. But for now, the solution was rather low tech, stick a book under it. Whereas all the Dell monitors, which aren't as bright and don't give as good a color reproduction, in my opinion, they have a little button on the back and you slide the thing up and down and stop it where it should be. And, you know, the ergonomicist went, oh, you just reach around the back. And he went, oh, sorry. Having just, you know, having him, I said, oh, a Mac user. I went, oh, yeah, Macs are great. And he went, okay, let's adjust this. Uh-oh.
Yeah. Well, you're maybe lucky it's too low, though. I've got it where it's a little too high, and there's not anything you can do about too high except sit you on a book.
Or take a hacksaw to something.
Definitely. Well, hey, we've definitely worn out. Remember, we're going to get down to 15 minutes this time? We're at 31 minutes right now.
Yeah, I think that 15 minutes is a bit of a pipe dream, but we should aim for it at least.
I think so.
Actually, imagine if we aim for half an hour.
Really, this would end up being a separate show, and maybe someday it will be a spinoff. You never know. This is certainly a lot of fun, and I know Jimmy Lee said we should go as long as possible. So just for you, Jimmy, we went an extra 15 minutes.
Yeah, that's it. It was planned. We swear. Yeah.
All right. Well, you've got some company coming over tonight, so I'm going to cut us off here. We'll talk to you soon, Bart.
Indeed. Until next time, happy computing.
Well, I sure hope you enjoyed the show today, and don't forget to make your short audio recordings telling me how you found the show. I really want to hear from you. Please do this. Well, okay, I want everybody but James to do this, because we don't. It's just better not to hear from him, you know. Anyway, send those audio files over to nosillacast@gmail.com. And keep sending in your questions, comments, and especially your dumb questions for Dumb Question Corner to Allison@podfeed.com. Thanks for listening, and stay subscribed.